And so it was decreed that each year the various districts of Pan-Am would offer up in tribute one young man and woman to fight to the death in a pageant of honor, courage, and sacrifice. The lone victor, bathed in riches, would serve as a reminder of our generosity and our forgiveness. This is how we remember our past. This is how we safeguard our future.
Welcome to Now Playing's bonus Hunger Games retrospective series.
This is history. Right here at this table.
Hosted by Jacob.
Everyone's either going to want to kiss you, kill you, or be you.
Stuart.
Everybody who's anybody is here, and they all want to meet you.
And Arnie.
Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
This podcast will contain detailed plot spoilers and harsh language.
It's appalling. Still, if you abandon your moral judgment, it can be fun.
Listener discretion is advised.
Let's get to work.
Today we're discussing The Hunger Games: Catching Fire, starring Jennifer Lawrence, Josh Hutcherson, Liam Hemsworth, Woody Harrelson, Elizabeth Banks, Lenny Kravitz, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Jeffrey Wright, Stanley Tucci, and Donald Sutherland, directed by Francis Lawrence. This is Arnie, and welcome to the 75th annual Now Playing Podcast review of Hunger Games.
Stuart in LA.
And this is your co-host on fire, Jacob.
You're still flaming?
Still flaming. I wasn't so hot on that first one, but we'll see with Catching Fire. I feel this is an improvement. I'll say that. Whether it's a recommend or not, I feel things have been improved here.
Well, things have been changed. That can be said decisively. We don't have the same writer. We don't have the same director. We don't have the same cinematographer. We don't have the same editors. Total change up. Why do that? Hunger Games made $400 million, $700 million worldwide. You would think that they would have locked in Gary Ross for all of the films to keep doing what he did, but they didn't have him under contract, and for whatever reason, he didn't want to come back.
Oh, he didn't want to come back? I figured...
He hates money, apparently.
I looked at Jacob and I both didn't recommend the first film. Just because the first film was financially successful doesn't mean a course correction might not have been gleaned from feedback and critics and things. And so I thought Lionsgate...
Most people like Hunger Games. If you look at Metacritic, most people were nicer than you guys were.
Yeah, you know, it's like when you say Rotten Tomatoes score is fact. I don't care what Metacritic says.
And I said a week not recommend. The problem with Now Playing is it's one or the other. So I feel like if we had some kind of score, it would more or less match up with the regular consensus was.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people were mixed on it, but I do feel like more people would have eked more on the green. And I don't feel like there was anything so problematic in the first movie that, you know, you would fire the director. No, he decided he didn't want to do it. My only guess is he was somebody that wanted to do other stuff, that maybe he thought, hey, I can do my thing now, that I don't have to be bound to a franchise that's going to take the next half decade of my life. I mean, it's quite a commitment.
And what's he done? Seabiscuit 2 or?
Well, that's the funny thing is he ended up making nothing, but I see he has something in the works, but it hasn't come out yet. And all that time that he could be making Hunger Games movies and Hunger Games money, I don't know what he was doing, but it was, you know, hopefully on personal growth. He did not do anything for his career. There are no films. Maybe there are scripts. I don't know. But it does happen. I remember the director of Twilight was not coming back, even though that was a big hit. And
Harry Potter.
50 Shades of Grey. They're not bringing back the same director. I mean, I think that sometimes these things don't work out. But my sense is nobody disliked Gary Ross. Nobody was dissatisfied with what he turned in. And they didn't have to go with Francis Lawrence, the director of I Am Legend and Constantine. But those are two movies that I kind of like, even though they're cheesy and pulpy. And I'm okay with it.
Well, at least he's used to working with effects action films versus Seabiscuit.
I'm sure there's some CGI horses in that.
Actually, yeah, I know there were some CGI in Seabiscuit. And Pleasantville had the nice black and white effects, but still, neither of which I would really classify as action films, which I don't know if I'd classify The Hunger Games as that either, having seen it, but it has action scenes.
I feel like it is science fiction, you know, a dramatic science fiction with action movie moments, but yes, I don't think that anybody that wants to see a lot of bloodshed or action or thrills, they'd be better served by Battle Royale. I do feel like, yeah, The Hunger Games are a little bit something different, but Francis Lawrence maybe gets closer to where you're coming from. He did lots of music videos. He's got a flashy visual style. He's bringing a new cinematographer, new editor. Arcade Fire is out. Coldplay is in. And we have two screenwriters to make up for the loss of Gary Ross. We have the writer of Toy Story 3 and Little Miss Sunshine. He did some work on Episode 7. We also have a Brit who worked a lot with Danny Boyle, Slumdog Millionaire, 127 Hours. I feel like there's talent here to replace whatever talent might be going out the door. And I do feel like most of my problems with that movie last week were technical. So having more technically proficient people sounds like the right way to go.
I had a few technical issues. My main issues were plotting and characterization and a little bit of acting. But really, I felt like the last one was set up. They were setting up a universe. That's great. Now let's play in the sandbox. Let's see what's happening in the rest of the districts. Let's explore this world more. I mean, that last movie ended on this kind of Katniss versus Snow emotion. I'm interested in seeing how that plays out in the rest of the world.
So do you guys assume there is another Hunger Games coming into this? I know you're not reading the books. You haven't seen the movie before. What did you think would happen? Did you think Katniss was going to get back into a ring, or did you think it was not going to take place in a Hunger Games?
No, I thought it was going to be outside the Hunger Games. Again, I kind of know that, like, they're going to rebel against the system at some point. I thought this would be building that rebellion. I'm blown away that we're going back to the Hunger Games in this film.
Okay.
I'm cynical. I figured Teen Wolf 2, you know, this is a sequel.
It's not that bad. Come on.
It's the Hunger Games. They will put her back in the ring. And my assumption was, since there were two winners for the first time ever, there would be some bullshit reason that that couldn't happen. And so somebody had to go back in.
Wouldn't fly in Thunderdome.
Yeah. I mean, I felt like she would get back in that game at some point because it was called the Hunger Games Catching Fire.
Right. I agree. You can't call it Hunger Games and not have a Hunger Games in it, although there wasn't much Thunderdome.
Yeah, if it takes place in that universe, this is the next part of that story. I thought we would actually move away from the Hunger Games as this went on.
Beyond Hunger Games, Son of Hunger Games, Curse of the Hunger Games. You have to tweak it.
But then I think it would have a title like that. Yeah, to say the Hunger Games Catching Fire. I felt she was getting back in the ring, but that's not the part that interested me. I was more interested in the world. And if she got back in the ring, I was hoping that it would be better than the last time she was in the ring. And truthfully, for most of this movie, I wasn't sure if she was getting back in the ring. But why don't we get into it? Stuart, you got a plot?
Welcome to the 75th annual Hunger Games, also known as the Quarter Quell. President Snow, played by Donald Sutherland, and new game maker Plutarch Heavensby, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, are contriving different rules for the Bloodsport's anniversary, designed specifically to punish Katniss Everdeen. Jennifer Lawrence's Huntress has become something of a folk hero since winning the last games, and her victory tour through the 12 suppressed colonies of Panem sparked several instances of civil disobedience. Basically, the slaves are tired of being exploited by the rich and heartless citizens of the capital, and they've identified Katniss as the face of their rebellion. And Snow will kill Katniss's mother, young sister Prim, and secret boyfriend Gale, unless she does a better job of selling her fake romance with fellow winner Peeta Mellark, again played by Josh Hutcherson. But Snow knows the real problem is that all the previous game winners hold too much sway over the public. And so he declares that a male and female victor from every district return to the arena for the All-Star Hunger Games reunion. Yes. And Woody Harrelson's Haymitch Abernathy is the one randomly chosen to join Katniss in the ring, but because we have the volunteer system, Peeta jumps in there to take his place. So it's pretty much exactly as it was last week. All of returning tributes are celebrities, though. but Katniss is the superstar, and many participants try to recruit her as an ally after the Huntress shows off her bow and arrow skills during target practice. Katniss reluctantly befriends a pair of nerds from District 3, played by Jeffrey Wright and Amanda Plummer, as well as an old woman named Mags. But she doesn't know whether she can trust flirty fisherman Finnick from District 4 or sneaky bad girl Johanna from Lumber District Number 7. Cinna, the stylist played by Lenny Kravitz, goes too far when he puts Katniss before the cameras dressed as a Mockingjay, a symbolic act that aligns her with the Mockingjay rebellion spreading through the colonies. Cinna is beaten and dragged away while Katniss is sucked up into a watery new arena designed to douse the flames of her rebellious spirit. The game begins, and tributes face an assortment of dangers including poisonous fog, tidal waves, and nasty mutant monkeys and birds. The District 3 nerds figure out that the whole place runs like a giant clock, and the good guys hatch a plan to harness the lightning that strikes a tree at regular 12-hour intervals so that the career tributes that are stalking them can be electrified. Katniss has great difficulty trusting her allies and wants to break away with PETA before things inevitably get ugly. President Snow believes the girl's paranoia will get the better of her and she'll tarnish her goody-goody reputation as well as that of the rebellions when she raises her bow against popular tribute Finnick. But Finnick convinces Katniss to shoot out the roof of the arena instead, shorting the power grid that runs the entire Hunger Games.
He does? Okay.
Yeah, I didn't get the sense. We'll discuss it.
Yeah.
Turns out Finnick, Haymitch, and Plutarch, and even Katniss's boyfriend Gale have been working behind the scenes to bring down the Quarter Quell. A hijacked hovercraft hauls Katniss out of the arena to safety, but PETA and Johanna aren't as lucky. President Snow captures them and proceeds to bomb District 12 into oblivion. Katniss and her family must now seek shelter with the rebels in a secret base tucked below the ruins of forgotten District Number 13. And the movie ends with Katniss putting on her game face and preparing for war as credits roll.
Well, we kind of got what I wanted. I wanted more about the universe and preparing for war. That's never a bad thing.
I actually feel like structurally, by design, we kind of get information at the exact same speed as we did last week. So
no, we do. I think we actually take a little bit longer to get to the games here. But because I'm into this universe, I'm with you, Arnie. Like, I didn't really go for that first film. It had problems, like, made me not recommend it, but I could go with this universe and I want to know more about it, so I'm more into it from the beginning here.
It's a very similar beginning.
It is. I'm kind of confused because I thought you'd be super rich and you'd live in the capital, but Katniss isn't. She's living in a nice house, but it's still in District 12.
Yeah, and I did notice the pacing thing. I wasn't sure going into this movie. I knew nothing. I couldn't even remember a trailer, but yeah, we're going to take about the same exact pace. We're going to spend 70 minutes, and then Katniss is going to enter the games. And in that 70 minutes, we're going to see her in District 12. We're going to see her chosen to go to the Hunger Games. We're going to see her train. We're going to see her wear a flaming dress again.
She's got to make friends again in this film. That's always her obstacles, making friends.
She needs to get on Facebook. That's the deal. So yeah, I did realize how much structurally like the last one this is. Which is a shame, because I was really excited at the beginning when it starts off with President Snow threatening Katniss's whole family. I'm like, that's pretty major if the president is coming to your house, threatening your family, and saying, you better convince me of this fake romance, especially when it started where we're seeing Katniss off with Gale, and I'm thinking those two are getting together.
Yeah, he kisses her. So we now know, I think this might be the first time he's ever done it, but she knew by being away from him how much he meant to her. And I think he knows now that she's back, he doesn't want to let her go. And there is no Team PETA. PETA is part of the problem. Picking PETA represents picking the capital and doing what Snow wants of her. So of course, she's going to pick the guy that goes hunting and slips out of the fence. And, you know, it's not for nothing that there's, quote, snow on the ground, symbolism that, you know, their world is now tarnished by snow, literally, and Donald Sutherland.
Yes, leave it to this pro-feminist film series to say the nerd still doesn't get the girl.
Is he a nerd?
PETA is the nerd?
He's kind of nerdy.
He's more of an artist to me.
Well, don't count out PETA yet. There's still two more movies.
True, but he's certainly not a Hemsworth. He's not the buff, ripped guy.
The dude could throw bags of flour, though. I mean, they just haven't shown it.
He can make you a cake that is delicious.
So maybe it's the arty guy doesn't get the girl.
You know, Stuart, you talked a lot about with The Hunger Games, the first film, that that ending worked for you because it's like, oh, we're trapped by this celebrity. It's a bad thing. I didn't get that at the end of this film. The beginning of this film really does set up that mood, and I feel that here. Like, Snow is coming in and making threats. Like, even though you got this nice house, he's still controlling you. She's still got to play this love story with PETA and still convince the people of the Capitol that they're in love. Like, I get that sense now in the beginning here.
Well, yeah, it's made overt. I mean, you're having a long dialogue about it with two really good actors. I really feel like this scene goes off because Sutherland and Lawrence are just so good in the scene. I mean, when she asked him, why don't you just kill me? I mean, it's true. Why doesn't he just kill her? I mean, the fact that he needs her to play along, that he wants to be her ally, you know, that this is like they're in the Hunger Games and they need to work together to survive is a funny notion.
I love the way Lawrence delivers the line, must be a fragile system if it can be brought down by a few berries.
Yeah, she's good in this. Arnie, you gotta admit, you weren't hot on her last time, but she's working now.
She has stepped up her game a little bit. I still don't like Katniss.
Are you a cat, Arnie? Because cats don't like Katniss. We didn't talk about it in the last film, but you get it here at the beginning too. Cats are always hissing at her for some reason.
And they recast that cat. It is a different looking cat than it was last week. Some people were outraged.
That's really funny because before I saw the first film, I thought her name was Catnip.
Gail does jokingly call her that. So she is called Catnip from time to time, but that is his affectionate term for her. But yes, the relationship with the cat, I think if they follow the books, will unfold. You'll see that cat again, but maybe it'll look very different. I don't know. A new movie, new cat.
Maybe it'll look like a CGI wolf. But yes, I think she's doing better here. More importantly, I feel like the screenwriters are giving her better lines. Last movie, she was such a passive character that I couldn't root for her. Here, when she's giving lines like it must be a fragile system just to be brought down by a few berries, it's giving her a spine I didn't really see in the last one. It is setting her up to be queen of a rebellion, which is a strange role. And again, I kind of am going to go to the young adult fiction trope. I mean, she's now seeming like Harry Potter to me. Harry Potter was the boy who lived. This was the girl on fire. I mean, she, because she's a teen girl and an avatar for the teen girl readers, is the leader, despite having absolutely no skill that seems to make her suited to be a leader of a rebellion.
It is the irony, is that she wants to lead no one. She wants to run off with Gale and have nothing to do with it. She's not thinking about saving anyone.
And that's what I love about Gale's character here, is that he's the opposite, that he does. He wants to stick around. He's not aligned with this girl that I think they have a relationship.
They do now, yes. That is just really opening up now. Again, with that first kiss, I feel like she wants to be with him. Again, I think part of that may have less to do with Hemsworth than just she wants to be away from Snow.
Yeah, I don't get the feeling she likes anybody. I wasn't sure in the last film, and we didn't talk about this, but I was really confused about her relationship with PETA there. I could never tell in the last film, was it an act, or was she really becoming connected to him? Whether that connection was simply, you know, like the summer camp connection, you get two people and you're in an intense circumstance away from everything for a while and you can tend to romanticize it, or whether it was legitimate feelings and she was coming to see the man inside of the cake maker. I didn't know if her feelings for him were real. I knew his feelings for her were. And so coming into this movie, now I'm not sure her feelings for anybody are real because PETA calls it out. I mean, they had a breakup or something when they got back to District 12, and PETA's pissed.
I mean, she said it at the end of the last movie, is that she wants to pretend that it never happened. Well, of course, PETA doesn't want that. This was a girl he always wanted to talk to. The Hunger Games were an icebreaker. But he wants to be with her, and now he lives 50 feet away, and she can't even look at him. She wants to ignore anything that they went through.
But she doesn't seem that much more attached to Gale, is what I'm saying. Is she wants to run away with Gale, but like you're saying, is it because it's Liam Hemsworth, or is it because he's someone to run away with her? And someone strong enough to be with her because he can hunt like she can hunt. I get the feeling she has no respect for PETA. She respects Gale, but I don't know that she loves him.
I think she does admire PETA, and we'll see in this movie certain moments where that admiration comes out. But I think it's easier to be with Gale because Gale doesn't ask her to be in love. I think that she can just be with him naturally in the forest, and whatever happens, happens. They can spend all day hunting and not speak, whereas Peeta wants validation. And I think that this really is Katniss's arc in this movie, is her standoffishness is really going to be challenged. She is going to be forced to make friends in this Hunger Games in a way that she never did last time. Outside of Rue, she really didn't have a collective group of alliances that were going to help her. And here, it's all going to be about her paranoia about why people want to help.
Now, Jacob, I got a question for you. I started to get that Twilight vibe. I've never seen Twilight. I've never read Twilight. But I'm kind of getting the feeling that Peeta is Edward and Gale is the werewolf with the ripped abs. Am I right on this? Wrong on this?
I don't really get a Edward Jacob vibe off of either. Well, yeah, they're doing the love triangle. I get that feeling.
But one seems really sensitive and mushy. The other's really ripped and bulging muscles. I don't know. Again, I've not seen it, but I thought they might be going for it.
Yeah, I don't see it here. Maybe that's because this love triangle doesn't really play out in this film. Maybe in Mockingjay, I'll get more of that vibe. But I get what you're saying, yes. But this is also young adult literature, so there has to be a love triangle.
Yeah, there needs to be a love triangle. I mean, just for tension's sake, but it's important to stress, Katniss doesn't want to be in love. She still very much is thinking about survival. She's thinking more about Snow and freedom and her family. I think her sister, again, less featured in this movie, but I still think is her primary concern. Raising Primrose is more important than either of these boys.
And I don't get that because, as you said, Primrose is barely in the film.
No, I get that Primrose, more than her mother, Primrose is who she really cares about the most, that she's trying to protect her. And that's why she's going to get pulled away. She has to go on tour. I guess that's what the winners do after they win, is they got to go around to all the other districts and end up in the capital.
God, I'm still thinking this is Jennifer Lawrence's rise to fame. The first movie, we saw her get a stylist. We saw her go on a talk show for the first time. We saw her learn to play an audience. Now we get to see her going around, and they say she's going to a bunch of cities and it's mostly parties. I'm like, yeah, that's Hollywood.
Yeah, I like this. I mean, I think they have a lot of fun always in this series, but particularly in this one, I love how they come out of their house and they're playing to the Capitol, and it's just a bunch of cameras on cranes there, that Caesar isn't even there, and they're having to stage some frolic in the snow romance for him. I mean, Snow has put the fear in her. She is trying to play ball.
They do kiss on camera. They give Snow, you know, he wants them to convince the Capitol that they're in love, and they kiss here.
I get that she's convincing the Capitol. She's got a good face on. She's playing it well. She might have wanted to let Peeta in on the plan because he just looks stunned and a little uncomfortable.
Well, the cameras are right there. They can't talk right then.
It's not just that, though. I mean, that's an important, important detail, is that Peeta says on the train, you know you don't love me, but maybe we can be friends. Why don't you tell me deep things? Why don't you tell me what's going on and we can deepen this relationship we have? She should absolutely tell him, I talked to Snow and this is what's going on. But because she's standoffish, she doesn't do it. And he's going to make a mistake because of it in District 11.
And we're joined by Cinna and Effie and Haymitch again on the tree. Effie seems, she's more likable in this film.
Like, yeah.
She seems much more into this couple now. Like, she worries about them. Like, I like her character a whole lot more here.
Well, she knows they're not going to die this time.
She seems more down to earth, though. I mean, she seems more grounded and worried in this film than she did in the last one. Last one, I just got highfalutin, nose-in-the-air socialite. Here, she actually comes across like a human.
I think last time, she didn't know that she had the winners. And this time, she's more popular by having access to them. I mean, again, with Effie, it's always about what you can do for her, how she looks. I mean, at some point, Woody Harrelson is going to insult her outfit, and 1 hour later, she's wearing something entirely different. She's very thin-skinned, and she's only thinking about herself. But I thought she was funny in the last movie. I think she continues to be a good source of comedic relief. She's increasing the rose theme, too. You know, we have a character named Primrose. We have Snow, who is always in the rose garden. These are symbols that are going to become very important in the later Mockingjay. And I feel like Effie is always being dressed up as flowers or roses. She has one outfit where she literally looks like a rosebud.
It seems weird that they got to go on this tour of the districts. Like, first they're going to go to District 11, which is an emotional one. That's where Rue was from. And is this just, like, rubbing it in their face that their district lost, like, as they do this tour? It almost feels like Snow is... But I guess this is what all the tributes do that win. But it feels like Snow is really doing this to make them hated by the other districts.
It's so weird, because on the one hand, I get that they're celebrities and that, like, going to these different cities and having meet and greets is, like... a famous author or a rock star going on tour. But by the same token, you're going to where you killed or where tributes from that area died. I mean, she will go to lands where she killed their contestants. And so they're not really greeted all that warmly, and there's no cheering, no applause. I like that. And I really do like that we're getting to see these other districts. I didn't realize that the districts were segregated. I didn't know all the black people were in 11, but it seems that way.
Do they racially segregate them, or is that just happen to be how it is in the film?
It is in 11, and I think in the book, racial identity is less easily understood, but they are always described as dark-skinned people in District 11, so I think it was, a choice to say that this is a segregated society here working in the agriculture district.
Oh, I didn't even get that it was an agriculture district. You're telling me that they're cotton pickers?
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, yeah, I guess they're not being subtle in their comparisons.
It's for teenagers. They can't be.
Well, I mean, you guys always act like subtlety is the most important thing. I think sometimes being blunt, particularly if there's a lot of information to convey, that's a good thing.
You say blunt, I say a little ham-fisted.
Well, okay. I mean, I like this world, and I like District 11, and I think that they are there as the spokespeople for Snow. Snow needs them to quell the anger. They work for him. The reason why they're going on tour is to fan out the animosity.
And you do see that with 11. There's a heavy military presence there. We know in the last film, they rioted after Katniss gave them the District 12 signal when Rue died. So this is a mending tour. They're there to make these districts feel good again. I really do like District 11, maybe because they're willing to fight for their rights and riot and push back.
I do like what happens in District 11. I like how it goes. I like that old man starts the salute.
Yes, and the whistle.
Yeah, and these stormtroopers come out of nowhere, bring him up on stage, and the way the door closes, but we just see enough to see a gun flash and, like, an explosion of brain matter. I mean, they push the boundaries on PG-13 in this one the way the last film didn't with that one shot, in my mind.
Yeah, it's a more graphic movie because they can kill adults. I mean, they have the liberty now to make the targets older than 18, and I think that we're just more comfortable while watching the brain matter of adults than we would be of adolescents. And I get that. I think that even if Gary Ross were back directing, he would have the freedom to film this scene in the same way.
And we also get, really, this is a sense where PETA and Katniss are still slaves to the system. We see PETA go off script. He's like, we're going to donate 1 month of our winnings to you guys every year because of Rue and Thresh. And then Katniss talks and talks about Rue and eulogizes her. And that's what got the old man to do the Mockingjay whistle and give the signal. Like, this is where they find out, no, they're not there to speak their hearts and tell others how they feel about the Hunger Games. It's to stay on script and make them like Snow.
Yeah, I think of it as kind of like if you've ever been in Little League or soccer or something, when you have to go and shake everybody's hand on the other team. Good game, good game, good game, good game. I feel like that's what they're doing here.
2, 4, 6, 8, who do we appreciate? Yeah.
It's a formality, and they're not supposed to put themselves in it, but they can't be that people. I mean, because PETA is sweet, and because Katniss had that connection with Rue, they're caving here. They look at these stone faces looking back at them, asking them to have a meaningful moment, and yeah, they go off script. And you wonder if PETA would have done it if Katniss had told him about the Snow interview, but because he does this, it's not even in the rules. He can't even do this. He's promising them things they can't even do. too, and all it's really doing is endangering his family back home. Snow could kill their families because of what they're doing here.
Yeah, and they're even told, in case you don't get that they're stuck doing this forever, Haymitch even says, you're mentors now, this goes on forever. There is no escaping being a tribute, no escaping the Hunger Games. And we see as they go to other districts, like the other districts will give that signal, and now they're ignoring it. Like, while these people are getting dragged off and beat, they're just giving this pro-Snow speech.
Yeah, when Haymitch says, you're trainers now, I really hoped that's where this movie would go, is that they're now the Haymitch, and the Hunger Games that were going to be in here, they were going to be training new tributes from District 12. They don't go there, they become tributes from District 12, but I'd really hoped, you know, Hunger Games, the next generation, maybe her sister, I think that's a little too on the nose, maybe other people, maybe new characters, maybe Gale gets picked. Or last year was his last year, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, he's out. He's working in the coal mines now. He's not eligible.
But while I'm liking this, I knew that something was going to come to a head. I would have liked to have seen her in a different role. Instead, we're going to kind of get a retread of her last role once this tour finally ends in disaster and she does not convince Snow of their relationship, though she seems to convince Snow's granddaughter.
Yeah, I feel like the granddaughter's to blame for what happens to Katniss in this film. Like, she's sitting there with the braid to the side, which is how Katniss wears her hair, and Snow's like, oh, you got a new hairdo, and she's like, all the girls wear their hair this way now. Like, you could see Katniss's influence. It's unfortunate that if this is going to be a feminist film, that it's through a hairdo, but we see that influence. I feel like that granddaughter gets Snow just as outraged as anything Katniss does.
Yeah, and I don't think Katniss could be a mentor. I think she would cave. I don't think that she has the stamina for it. I don't think she could do it. I mean, you get it in that one little moment. She's appearing in some district, and some little girl runs up and says, when I'm old enough, I'm going to volunteer just like you.
Oh, that's so awful.
Well, that's not the message she wanted to leave them with.
No. No, there's lots of little moments like that where I feel like it rides that line of like being enough and being a little too much. Like the braid, yeah, when the girl runs up and says, I want to volunteer, I like that. When they finally get to the presidential house and they're mingling with all these people and someone's like, oh, we drink this so we could vomit and keep eating. And they're like, they're throwing up because they eat so much and we have nothing to eat. Yeah, I got that. Thanks for putting a fine point on it.
I kind of liked the vomitorium idea, though. I mean,
it's very Greek, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And the conversation, it wasn't drawn out. It didn't bother me.
Yeah, they underlined a point that may be missed by younger audiences and continue on with the movie. I gotta point out that just the production design. I mean, this is what I was talking about last week. What a world of difference. I don't know how much bigger the budget was, but it looks like you have three times the movie now that you did last week.
We got spaceships now, or hovercrafts or something, whatever you want to call them.
Yeah, they were in the last one. They just looked bad.
Okay, maybe that's why I don't remember them.
We also got Philip Seymour Hoffman now. He's introduced. And again, we talked about him with Mission Impossible, and I like this actor. I knew beforehand that he was in this because I saw his name on a list I was looking at, but I didn't know his role. I didn't know who he'd be. I didn't know if he'd be fighting in the Hunger Games. I had no idea, but he is the new game master. So I'm thinking, oh, he's a snidely villain again. He's going to be like he was in the Mission Impossible series. He's a new bad guy, and he plays bad guys creepily.
I love Hoffman here. I love his name, Plutarch. Yeah, that says bad guy to me.
I feel like whenever he does commercial work, I feel like Philip Seymour Hoffman makes more sense as a not nice guy than he does as a hero. He's not really leading man major motion picture material. So, yeah, it would be easy to presume that he is going to be the antagonist. He could be even worse than Snow. We have a lot of scenes that are never appearing in the book between him and Snow having a dialogue about what to do with Katniss. And I think that these are incredibly helpful, well-written scenes. I love all of those scenes being included here.
What I really love about Hoffman's performance is everyone's so flowery. I mean, we talked about literally some people look like flowers, but everyone's so flowery. His performance, the way he speaks, it could be like one of his small indie movies he's appearing in. Like, there's nothing flowery about this character. He does not buy into this image, of the capital of what the Hunger Games are supposed to mean, which really makes me think, is this guy a good guy or a bad guy? I never quite know as this film goes on what side he's on, because he doesn't seem like the rest of the people in the capital.
And here, I just thought he was a bad guy from the beginning. His flat delivery, I thought he had complete contempt for Katniss when he's like, this is a job that doesn't have a lot of career longevity, but you inspired me to come back. Now we're going to find out at the end what that meant. I took it as, I'm here to make sure you die.
Yeah, that's how I took it when he had that discussion with her.
Yeah, and they could have gone too far in this. In the book, that this scene actually, they almost telegraph to you that he is part of the Mockingjay rebellion. And they pull back from that, and I think it's wise. We need to believe for much of this movie that he wants to squash her.
I do. Especially because it's Philip Seymour Hoffman. Great casting. And you mentioned the scenes with Donald Sutherland. Sutherland is again dominating here. And anytime you get Hoffman and Sutherland together, yes, I love those scenes. The two great actors. And Donald Sutherland, he's not a great actor, but he's great in this. Playing off of a truly great actor in Seymour Hoffman.
I love where Hoffman has that, like, tells him what his plan is. Like, fear, more floggings, more executions. What kind of dress is she going to wear? Floggings. Like, I just love that speech against Snow.
And honestly, it felt like White House conversation to me. Because during the worst time of our country, we're focused on Britney Spears shaving her head. So, it didn't seem that far from reality.
Right. That's the satire they're always good at, and I think it is helpful to get away from Katniss's point of view and see behind closed doors what people are thinking, or what we think they might be thinking. We'll find out. We don't really know Plutarch until the last moments. But did you catch the little moment? I didn't know how to interpret it at first, and then when I went back and read Mockingjay, I was like, oh, at that big presidential party, he does a toast, sips the champagne, and then stops drinking because the glass is suddenly filled with blood. Did you guys notice this?
I noticed he stopped drinking. I thought it was kind of just an FU to Katniss, because this firework display starts and everyone's looking at it, except Katniss and Snow are staring at each other. So I thought it was like, I'm putting down this pretense and really not celebrating you. What is the blood from?
That's what I thought too, Jacob. I was right there.
No, there is something medically wrong with the president, and I'm going to wait for them to tell you, but yeah, the fact that he can't get a glass of wine down without spitting up blood will play out later. But it's Katniss's idea to get married. I mean, she is still trying to save her family. Again, I think it's Primrose more than anything. She's kind of mad at her mother, and Gale can take care of himself, but Primrose needs to be protected from Snow. She'll do anything to do that. She will marry Peeta. And so they agree to get married even as she returns home into the arms of Gale, making it very clear that she's ready to run away with him right now, that very day.
Yeah, but Gale's not going to. He's like, there's talk in the mines that we're going to fight, and he wants to stay there and fight just as more stormtroopers show up into District 12.
More floggings.
Yes, as Plutarch said.
And Gale will be one of the first victims because he takes a stand against the new commander. Yes, he will be strapped to a post and whipped. And this is really where the screenwriters have done a better job than the book defining why the Quarter Quell is about sending tributes back. Because three victors are caught on camera,
yes,
shouting yeah. down peacekeepers. That is why Snow realizes, oh, we got to screw them all. And that's not in the book, or at least I never saw it that clearly in the book. And here, I think the screenwriters have done an excellent job of explaining the Quell. There's also a deleted scene. I don't know if it would be helpful for you guys, but they make explicitly clear that there are different rules for what the Quell is going to be. And Philip Seymour Hoffman goes and burns them and puts this idea of old tributes going back in as the replacement envelope.
Oh, see, I thought they just made up the whole Quarter Quell thing as an excuse to get old tributes to fight, to set up Katniss. I didn't think that was a real thing. Is like, oh, look, we happen to find this in our constitution.
No, every 25 years they do it special. One year it was a double the tributes, so, you know, it'd be
Battle Royale.
It would be Battle Royale numbers. And that was the year that Haymitch won. I mean, I think it's really sad that we don't learn the story of Woody Harrelson.
So he beat 41 other people?
Yes. They make clear, they go back to it many times. They explain how he could win, what his strategy was, who he was back then. I think all of that stuff is really good, and that's why you should go read the book. But it's not here, and they don't even try to get that in.
Artie, I take it from your earlier comments that you don't like that Katniss is going to go back into the Hunger Games.
No, it all depends on how it's done.
Okay, well, I like this setup because it's not really about the Hunger Games. This is all politically motivated, more so than, oh, we're going to keep these 12 districts down by making them tribute their kids. But this is really, all these pieces are in motion now. There's talk of rebellion. There's Snow trying to keep control of the districts. Like, this whole setup for the 75th Hunger Games of having old tributes go, there's more to this than just, oh yeah, every year we have a Hunger Games. That's why I buy this setup, that I'm willing to go with this now. I feel like there is danger with Katniss, probably because Hoffman is now the game creator and Plutarch is just such a great villain. Like, I feel like he's going to make something dangerous. I feel like Snow really has it in for Katniss this time and wants her dead. Like, I like the setup. I don't think this is going to be about Hunger Games per se, but they're going to use those games to move this bigger story along about rebellion.
And I really like Commander Thread in this, whipping Gale and everything. I get the impression that he's being set up to do more later. I kind of get like he's a Grand Moff Tarkin kind of thing.
Yeah, they give him a name, so he's got to do something later.
They give him a name and they show that he's willing to kill them no matter who they are after he's talked down by Haymitch. Plus the idea of bringing multiple Hunger Games winners back. I knew or thought Katniss would get back in the ring. I didn't know about PETA, but to have basically the Hunger Games All-Stars, I'm still equating this to reality TV. And how often do you see that? Whether you go to
Project Runway All-Star, Survivor All-Star, yeah.
Celebrity Apprentice. Hell, go back to Road Rules versus the Real World Game. You know?
You can go back further to the 70s, Battle of the All-Stars. Remember, they used to put people from primetime shows in these cheesy Olympics.
Oh, God, yeah, that was hilarious. I loved that.
It's fun. I mean, watching people degrade themselves is good enough, but when it's famous people degrading themselves, so much better.
Yeah, and in the case of reality TV, they may only be famous from that show, but if you're bringing the best of the previous seasons back together, then that's a way to see who's really the champ. So I went with this conceit. I like it as a concept. I want to see who the others were, and they're kind of cool. I like the woman who filed her teeth into points.
Well, you know, first of all, I was wondering if they might mix it up by sending back a different boy tribute. I mean, Katniss knows she has to go. She's the only girl from District 12 that's ever been, but Haymitch is the one that got picked.
And there's talk that, like, Haymitch says he'll volunteer if PETA gets picked, but he can't do anything if PETA volunteers. And I love Effie here. Like, she is sad when she has to reach her hand into that bowl with one lone name for Katniss. Like, you could tell how downtrodden she is. I come around on her character in this film.
She's playing her part still. I mean, she has mastered the art of delivering bad news with a smile. That is what her job is. She is a PR person.
See, I feel like she's struggling with that at this point.
Oh, yeah, no, it's coming through. She's breaking because, again, she thought she had winners. And to know that it's been rigged so that they'll never win, it's painful. It is painful. But it's just as painful for me to watch PETA because, I mean, he's enlisting. All right, maybe partly he's enlisting to protect Katniss, but I don't think he really thinks that he can protect her any better than Haymitch could.
I kind of wanted to see Haymitch in the games.
Me too. I really wanted PETA to stay home.
But I think PETA is doing it because there's nothing for him there. Later, he will have a dialogue in which he says, nobody cares about me. He has nothing to live for. He's lonely. He lives by himself. He doesn't live in the bakery. And his family, while never shown in this movie, it's clear in the book, they don't think much of him. And so, yeah, he's basically willing to die and will try to protect Katniss where he can. Like, he invents some false pregnancy rumor that he spreads around to make her look less killable.
I like that. I actually thought that was pretty smart of him. It's one of the few times I've actually appreciated him as a character being smart. I always felt like in every way he was inferior to Katniss. And here, he got a moment to show, hey, I have good ideas. You should count on me a little bit more. But did you guys buy it? And I don't know if I didn't buy the character or if I didn't buy the performance, but when Katniss goes to Haymitch and says, make sure he survives instead of me, it felt to me like that's the thing she should say, but I just never got the feeling that that's the thing she wanted to say or meant.
I think what it's really saying, I think what everyone is saying is, I don't want to live anymore. I can't win. There are no winners. There's only survivors. And to survive in this world is painful. I think that it's defeatism. She's basically saying, well, he has more hope in him. He is a more genuinely good person than I am. And I think she recognizes that. I think we all recognize that PETA is the sweeter one of the two. She's trying to preserve that. That same instinct to protect her sister at all costs, she wants to protect innocence.
Yeah, that's how I took it, is that, yeah, protecting innocence, that she's willing to make that sacrifice. I don't know if she still has it in her to kill other people, but she's willing to sacrifice herself. I mean, we're going to see her with arms outstretched in the Christ pose by the end of this film, but she's willing to make that sacrifice to save other people.
Yeah, and the other people, I mean, a trickier idea is that all these other people are already loved. They've already proven themselves. So while I do think Katniss is the latest flavor, all of these people that she's competing with have their fans.
I do feel like more loved than others, but I do like that we get names. We get like who these other characters that they're going to be fighting are. I feel like I'm invested now in this fight. We get Kashmir and Gloss, the brother and sister winners from District 1, and we get the nerds that use their brains to win. We get Brutus and Enembrier, I don't even know how to say her name, but she filed her teeth down to fangs. Like, I like that the stakes are higher here. I'm more invested because these seem like scarier people to fight, and I'm getting to know who they are.
Yes, I was just about to say that, is last time we didn't know any of these people. Here, I think we get all of their names, but we also get each of their characteristics, you know? She has the teeth. He's really good in the water.
Yeah, we have Morphlings who are really good at hiding out. And we get Finnick, who is the youngest ever winner, who ironically is teamed up with Mags, who is the oldest one in the games.
And the fact that there's alliances going into the game, which we didn't have last time. Last time it was every man for themselves right from the get-go. Here, they're going to form alliances before they ever get in the ring or the arena. I like that we get a chance to meet them. This is what I was talking about last time when I said I wanted a bit more of the opponents. And the fact that they're all pissed to be there. I thought there might be some who were trained for life and they're like, yes, I get to win again and get even more money or prizes. But every single one of them is pissed and they're doing their different things when they're being interviewed by Caesar to let it be known that I don't really want to fight this game again, but I'm here because of the law.
I also, you know, you talk about these films having more money. Instead of throwing knives or bow and arrows being shot at mannequins, now they got these like weird digital pixel things that run at you when you kill them, and like they explode into pixels. They really have upgraded their training.
Well, they have more money. I mean, I think at some point someone says the Capitol has spared no expense for these games, and I'm like, yeah, you make $400 million and suddenly there's a budget for special effects that there wasn't there before. But yeah, this is what I'm talking about, is I wish they'd go back and remake that first movie on this budget, because it would just be so much more impressive. But yes, I mean, I hear you. I think that these are interesting characters. I think this story is about her forming more relationships. So we're going to see her interact more. And, you know, she's picking losers.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's expected, though.
She's never going for, like, the big buff people that have brute strength. She's going with, like, the 80-year-old lady or the nerds.
Well, Amanda Plummer, she could be crazy. Go listen to our Pulp Fiction review.
Oh, yeah, no, she's scary.
I really wish she would have said, I'm going to execute every motherfucking last one of you. I'm just going to. I was wishing for that the whole time. And I said she was kind of a weird person when we were reviewing Pulp Fiction. I haven't seen her in 20 years. She got weirder.
Tick tock, tick tock, tick tock.
Yeah, if you want a crazy lady, she does that. And Jeffrey Wright, we've enjoyed him in different kinds of parts. He's in the Bond universe most recently, but they're a fun couple, but they're not who I would pal around. I mean, I think she's still being Katniss. She's still picking the hard luck cases. She looks at the weaker ones, and those are the ones she wants to align with. She never wants to be with aggressors. And I think that you guys were giving her knocks last week that she didn't kill more, but that is her character.
Well, I get that here with those who she picks before. She ties herself up in trees for most of that film. Now she's forced to make friends. And yeah, I get it that your hero, you're going to pick the other underdogs. But I feel like there is some strategy by befriending Mags. You're also going to get Finnick, who's a really great fighter, because, you know, he wants to protect Mags. They're from the same district.
Yeah, he was the youngest winner. She's probably the oldest one ever to go in the games.
I never knew when they were doing the cue cards that she was mute. She never says a word. She just kind of mimes everything. I found that an interesting characteristic.
Yeah, I don't know why they did that. In the books, there are a whole class of people that have their tongues removed and they're becoming servants. I don't think that happened to her. I'm not exactly sure why they made that choice, other than it just sort of makes her kind of sweet. You know, like she can't back talk. She can't really do anything except express herself through her face. And so you either have to pay attention to her or you wouldn't even notice her. But because Katniss cares, she's, again, a human character. We want her to survive. We know she's dead meat. I mean, there's just no way that the 80-year-old is going to pull this one out of the fire. But we love the idea that they're going to all rally around her and try to protect her as long as they can.
And I didn't know going in. I'm like, well, obviously Katniss survives. We got two more movies to review and I see Jennifer Lawrence on the posters. But is it going to be just one survivor this time? I could see them killing PETA and going for the tug the heartstrings moment. This returning character who was so major last time dies. You know, it's like throwing Han and Carbonite. And would she kill others? Has she hardened to this? Would everybody else there die? I was curious about that. But yet part of me, especially when they're all on stage and they all raise their hands together, felt like there could also be just a complete rebellion of all of the tributes teaming up and just rebelling, refusing to fight and working together. It doesn't go either direction. It kind of splits the difference.
They kill the lights. They turn it off. They're like, show over when it starts to look that way.
Yeah, you find out like half of these tributes want to be in alliance with Katniss. Like, and she's surprised by that. I do like the way Joanna goes about making alliances by stripping in an elevator.
You got the boys to notice.
I would immediately join her alliance. Absolutely. I would join the alliance in the front and the back, however she wants.
And the other thing I like is, again, sequel, this has got to seem bigger. You got to up the stakes. Katniss can't just shoot the pig again. Like, you find out there's a force field around the sponsors. And I love, like, what they do when they have to display their skills. You see PETA walk out, and she walks in, and we never see what PETA did, but she looks on the ground, and you see this painting of Rue with the flowers around her. I'm like, oh, damn, that is a political statement. And I think it inspires Katniss to do this effigy of Seneca, the game master from the last film, and, like, lynch him. I'm like, okay, there's much more defiance going on. And then we go into Caesar's show that we talked about, where they all hold hands, and Joanna's cursing everyone out. Like, this feels tenser.
Well, if you want to talk about political statements, nobody does it better than Lenny Kravitz. I mean, da 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 da, baby, it's over, Lenny. I know you in the song you say it's not over till it's over, but it is over for Senna. He is killed here. I don't know if that's clear, but he dies.
It doesn't come across that he was killed.
Unless they pull something different for the movie that is not in the book, he is going to die for this wedding dress trick.
I got that he would die for that. I really did. And again, I'm amazed that only she has these magical dresses, but it is a good trick to play on the people.
He has patented that technology.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, I do like when you see this, you know, I'm like, oh, she's going to twirl and the dress is going to be on fire again. No, this time it like burns up in ashes. And at first I'm like, wait, is this Aronofsky's Black Swan?
Yes,
like,
I thought the same thing.
It's got wings and everything, but I'm like, oh, okay, that's the Mockingjay. Yeah, right there is a political statement.
Any alliance to that was, she was trying to get away from it. the whole time. She did not want to be seen as part of the rebellion because, again, I think of Primrose. It's an interesting moment. I study her face in this because she could be really mad. I mean, she just now has exposed herself.
Yeah, she doesn't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, well, she's just now made the largest statement yet that she is politically aligned with this rebellion. I mean, Primrose could die for this. I mean, she could be taken out to the shed and shot because her sister is up there promoting the rebellion.
I mean, I think what's interesting, though, is that there is this whole balance because Snow knows that people follow this stuff for its entertainment value or whatnot. So when PETA says, oh, it's just a shame that we'll never get to see this baby, like, you could see they're pulling on all these different angles, so you don't know how much Snow could just do. Can he just go and start bombing the districts without the people in the Capitol revolting? I really feel like this is a chess game going on.
I feel like Primrose could be killed.
But I feel at this moment that this is the first time Katniss says, okay, I'm going to stand with him. I'll be the Mockingjay in this moment. She doesn't have much choice unless she wants to strip naked, but I also see in the performance, rather than anger at Cinna, it becomes self-actualization. She says, all right, take that, Snow. I mean, I feel like it is a way of really hurting the president. And, well, we know for sure that it hurts Cinna. I'm not clear if Primrose doesn't get tortured. Later, we're going to hear a bird echo her sounds as she screams, and that may have come from just this kind of scenario.
Did it in the book?
Never clear.
Yeah, we'll find out. Things don't end well for District 12 by the end of this film. But we get into the games, and again, upping the tension as Katniss is going up in her tube to go to her little platform, you see Cinna beat up by the guard here. And I guess, yeah, I guess he could have died from that. To me, it looked like they beat him up. They could be taking him to prison. Who knows?
They do take him away, but you won't ever see him in the story again unless the movies have a different plan for Lenny Kravitz than Suzanne Collins does. But I love the fact that the girl on fire pops up. She's surrounded by water. This is Snow's way of saying, I'm dousing you. You are dead.
I was surprised she went for the weapons. I mean, in the last movie, the thing that Hamish said is, whatever you do, don't run towards the stockpile. It's a bloodbath. And so she seems to have forgotten that pretty quick. She goes right for it.
It's different here, though. They got to swim, and then they jump up on those stones and run along. But there's alliances right at the beginning here. The things have been formed, so I guess there's people watching her back.
Well, a change from the book that might have been helpful is there was no Snow at the beginning of the book. They wanted to make that symbol for the movie, but if the lake that she was standing at had not been snowed over, you would have had a scene of her showing that she was an excellent swimmer in the beginning of this movie, that she had gone to the Forbidden Lake and learned how to swim. But keep in mind, a lot of districts don't have access to water like that, so they wouldn't know how to swim. Only the Fisherman District and her, and maybe the tributes from 1 and 2, because they're really well trained, would have any real swimming skills. So she has better odds at getting her bow.
And she does get it, and I was surprised. I mean, she does shoot one tribute in the leg. I'm like, all right, well, she's not killing. But she is being aggressive. She runs to get the bow. She shoots the one guy in her leg, and then she points it right at Finnick. She was ready to kill Finnick until he flashes that bracelet to say we're allies.
Yeah, earlier Effie wanted everyone to be in gold. She has gold hair. Katniss has the gold Mockingjay pin. She makes gold for PETA and Haymitch, and so I guess she made Finnick a piece of gold, a gold bracelet, so they knew they were allies.
No, that is Haymitch's bracelet.
Oh, that is his bracelet. Okay.
Yes. She knows that Haymitch is endorsing this guy because he's wearing the bracelet that only Haymitch had.
And Finnick, I really like him. I haven't seen this actor in anything else, but I get a real young Val Kilmer vibe off this guy. The blonde hair, the big face, the sugar cubes for him are like the equivalent of how Val Kilmer chattered his teeth or clicked his teeth together when he was playing Iceman in Top Gun.
I thought you were going to say how he ate a bunch of sugar and ended up the way he is now.
Yeah, don't be too much like Val Kilmer, kids. But I agree. I really like the performance. What I like about it is the voice. He's an English actor, but he has nailed that annoying American accent. There is something kind of vacuous about the way that Finnick speaks, that he feels like this arrogant playboy that we've feel like we shouldn't like him, right? He is set up so clearly as an enemy. That voice and his arrogance, it's always taunting us to not trust him. We're on Katniss's side that she would want to shoot an arrow in him.
I think he's going to betray her the whole movie. I do not trust him. I trust Mags, but him, I don't know. He's too preppy, you know? He's just too Ivy League that he would not hang with someone from District 12.
I don't know if the movies will dare to go there, but his story is really, really sad. You hear a little bit about it with Annie. He liked another tribute that could have gotten picked, but Mags volunteered to take her place. We do see that moment happen very briefly, but Annie is really emotionally screwed up. And he loved her before she entered the games. After she came back from the games, she was ruined. And even though he's this playboy that has all the women that he wants, the only woman that he wants, he can't have because she's gone mad.
I also like Johanna, Jenna Malone here. I've seen her in a bunch of stuff, kind of like a Kristen Stewart with better acting. And she's the one who just went up on stage and just threw a tantrum about how bullshitty it is that she's put it back in the game. But she brings a good energy. She brings the emotion that Katniss can't show. And I like seeing her in this role and also as another ally to the group.
Yeah, both Finnick and Johanna are characters that we feel we shouldn't trust. And yet every time they keep doing things that are like, oh, all right, PETA's going to chop into a electrical cord and Finnick's going to revive him. And, oh, okay, normally a calculating character would at the very least let him die, if not out and out suffocate or stab him in that moment.
I was thinking about that with the CPR. I'm like, are you reviving someone just so he can kill you?
Yeah.
I mean, as your plot summary said, there's a big conspiracy going on and they're all in on it. But watching this movie, I'm like, that might not be the best strategy.
Yeah, to me, I mean, unless there's going to be a huge betrayal that tells me that we could probably trust Finnick. And again, unless he's really trying to get Katniss on his side and believe that he's a good guy. I am wondering, though, like, how did the nerds make it out of this opening scene alive? Like,
they swam away, right? They didn't even try.
They went for the high land, like Katniss was told to do in the first film, I guess.
He went somewhere to pull a coil of wire out of his ass.
But there isn't really Highland here. Like, you talked about this force field. It feels much more claustrophobic. There isn't a lot of places to go.
And there's no water. You know, they have some spile sent to them. It's the only sponsor donation of the movie, so they can tap the trees. But yeah, it's all salt water. They can't drink the lagoon water, so they have to get this room temperature water out of a tree.
I kind of like that, like tapping a cactus in the desert. It was kind of a cool thing, and they have a lot of shots of it and people drinking from it.
Yeah, but they can't sit around in this one like before. Like, right away, like at night, this fog comes down that I guess like burns your skin, gives you boils or something.
It's poisonous in some way.
Yeah, this was always so horrifying. When I saw this movie the first time, I was just like, ooh. All I could think returning to Catching Fire was, oh, I'm going to have to watch that boil fog again. There's something very upsetting about it. I don't know why, but I don't like it. I mean, rather, I should say, I really love it as a threat. But what a horrible way to go.
Yeah, having to try to get away from a fog, like, it moves like a ghost. How do you run away from fog?
Yeah.
I kind of thought it would be a painless death. I mean, this is where Mags dies. I think it's so quick. You know, if you're running from it, it becomes much worse because it seems like it's burning them and they're screaming. But if you just let it come over you, it's so poisonous, you're going to die really quick.
So just give up is what you're saying.
I'm saying Mags had the right idea there. Instead of trying to run and failing, go right into it. If you know you're dead anyway, why linger?
She didn't want to slow down Finnick. I mean, she had been piggyback riding him, and she knew that he had enough boils that it was just enough for him to try and get away. She died so they could live.
I thought she died so that PETA could live.
Yeah, that's how I took it. She sacrificed herself for PETA because PETA was injured.
Oh, yeah, you're right. The movie does that. It's a little different in the book.
Okay. But you figure something is going on. Either there's some weird structure to the game, or maybe, you know, the Game Master, we know they can control where this fog goes. They can pull it back whenever they want. Maybe he's trying to manipulate it. But we see that fog, all of a sudden it just stops and, like, raises up into the air and stops following them.
That was kind of weird. And honestly, what I thought was Philip Seymour Hoffman was fucking with them and pulled a vacuum. It's like just sucking the air straight up. I did not get this whole clock thing.
Well, I don't know how anyone would. I mean, it's the kind of thing that you have to write a genius in to tell the audience, because we had a scene. She climbed a tree. She looked at it, and it was not evident that this was a clock until Amanda Plummer said, tick tock, tick tock, tick tock, and Katniss went, oh, you're right. I mean, I would have never come to that conclusion.
Well, would you come to the conclusion that you just got to dip yourself in some water to get rid of whatever this mist did to you?
I'd be grateful that that was that easy.
It seems almost as painful as when they got burned, though, when they have to go in that water.
I'm telling you, this whole scene is very upsetting.
When you get chemical burns, I don't think water is actually what you're supposed to put on it, but nonetheless, that would be my instinct, too. Wash it off. It heals them very quickly. I mean, it does not leave lasting boils. I really wondered if for the rest of the movie they'd be walking around with these big white boils on their face. Nah, they just wash away.
Too many bad publicity pictures. They need for these people to look good in other scenes. You can have them covered in nasty boils for one shot, but you don't want them looking that way the whole time.
Are you talking from a movie perspective or a Hunger Games media perspective?
No, I'm saying from a person trying to market a movie to teenagers, you don't want Jennifer Lawrence in most of the movie being covered in white boils. That does not sell movie tickets.
And the danger just keeps coming. Like, if those dogs didn't work for you, I feel like this is an upgrade. These baboons that come after them. Just monkeys are scarier than dogs, I think. There's something just so vicious, especially baboons with their fangs and their red butts.
I thought they were trying to just play off the success of Rise of the Planet of the Apes or Dawn, whichever one had come out by this point.
No, it's in the book, and I mean, there will be mutations, that's what they call them, mutations in all of the movies. We had the dogs last time. We're going to get something else in part two, I would presume. It's a thing of the trilogy that you're going to get the genetically modified capital monster.
Yeah, I didn't get a sense that these were modified, but they were mean. I mean, they're programmed to attack.
Yeah, it happened so fast, I almost didn't really see it, but we have another character sacrificing themselves to help Katniss, that there's one of the morphlings that are hiding in the background, jumping forward to protect her. You get the sense that people are going out of their way to make sure Katniss doesn't go down. The opposite of what she assumed would happen in the arena.
Yeah, and this is where I really got that okay, something else is up besides these games, because PETA's going to say, yeah, that morphling sacrificed herself for you, and I got it. Okay, people wanted to be on her side, on her alliance. Oh, sure, but this is where, you know, the conspiracy, if you want to call it that or whatever, something bigger is happening at this point.
And I didn't take it as a conspiracy. I will admit, until the very last frame, I didn't realize what was up. What I thought it was, and it's just such a Mary Sue concept, and that's what I kind of feel Katniss is at times, is that she was so inspirational to everyone. Everyone saluted her. So people were just spontaneously sacrificing themselves because she was a symbol of rebellion. I didn't think they were all like plotting and conniving in unison to do this. I just thought people, even previous victorious tributes, were so in favor of what she had inspired that they were doing this.
And it happened so fast, you don't really think about it much. I mean, I don't pay attention to it. It just kind of blows by like, oh, that's weird. Anyway, moving on to the raining blood and tidal waves and everything else they got coming at them on an hourly basis.
Yeah, I actually dwelled on that thought for a while.
No, so did I, because I really figured, okay, people are doing something to save Katniss without her knowing. Like, I had the opposite response to you, Arnie. I didn't think they were sacrificing themselves because she's so great in this Mary Sue. I figured because they see her as a political leader of this rebellion, that maybe something's going on to save her on purpose, that they're willing to die so she will be the last one alive.
Well, that is the correct interpretation. Congratulations for figuring it out.
I always like it when I can figure out a movie. It's an active way for me to watch when there's some mystery going on. And I did not figure out the true answer of this one.
I didn't figure out what's going to happen by the end of this, but I saw seeds being planted.
And I never figured out Philip Seymour Hoffman's role till it was revealed either. We get another great scene of him with Snow. I thought we were at Plutarch's home, But I guess we're just in his production studio, but he's like, make yourself at home to Snow, who's the president. I figure he will anyway. But I really get from this that Plutarch is engineered these games just so, and everything's going to fall apart, and he's just so confident in it, and he's going to go take a nap now. I'm loving him as an evil character, and I never questioned his motives of evil.
Yeah, I almost feel like, you know, to preview our Star Wars prequels a little bit, you know, there's a scene where Count Dooku, he's got a bunch of Jedi in this arena, and some of the bad guys are like, can't we just shoot them? Can't we just kill them now? And I feel like you get that relationship with Snow and Plutarch. Like, Snow just wants Katniss dead. He's like, no, we gotta play this up. She's gotta be, like, the last one to die. Like, there's something else going on, we'll find out. But I do feel like, yeah, he doesn't come off as obviously trying to play Snow at this point. He just seems like a really good game maker.
This is a hard balance for him, because he could end up killing Katniss. I mean, all of these things, he needs to look like he's doing his job. He cannot, like, have fog that doesn't kill coming out. He can't have clowns and balloons and puppy dogs running out. I mean, he has to make this look like a really threatening arena. But by having it being built like a clock, it gives them a way of staying ahead of the danger, at least until he spins them around and they don't know what time it is anymore.
Yeah, but they got the nerds, or I guess one of the nerds is left. Amanda Plummer's character dies at this point.
Yeah, one of the tributes, career tributes. We get a Katniss death around the same time she did last movie. She delivers an arrow to one of the District 1 guys.
So the plan is, you know, there's this tree that lightning is always hitting. I guess that has something to do with the clock. And so they want to, basically, they figure if they all leave, the careers will come down by the water, and they could use that tree that gets all that lightning, run a wire, and try to electrocute all the careers.
Yes. Although that sounds fanciful, and then not really what they're trying to do. They're trying to get that lightning to short out the ceiling, but they can't say that.
Yeah, everyone else is in on this but Katniss, right?
Yes.
And why don't they bring Katniss in on it? Do they not trust her? Is she too...
No, they're afraid that if she knows, Snow will catch on because she'll start acting different. So they're trying to protect her and protect the plan from Snow.
And again, how would you tell anyone anything in this universe? Once you're in the arena, there are hundreds, thousands, I don't know how many people are in Panem, but there are all of these people watching you, so you never have any moment of privacy. There's not one second where you can have this dialogue. All of these alliances were formed before they got into the arena.
Exactly. Hammich gave Finnick that bracelet. Hammich could have said, hey, by the way, I'm working on this.
To her, yes.
Yes.
The fact that he doesn't do it is kind of a taste of her own medicine. It's the same instinct that made her not trust PETA with the knowledge of what Snow told her. That, yes, you have people that feel like playing other people, that this is a game, and that rather than making them allies, they're playing her. And I think that frustration is only going to bloom. In fact, I know it because I've read the book, but she's going to end up resenting them having more knowledge than her as the movies progress.
Yeah, but I feel like Snow is savvy enough that if Katniss was in on this, he would have noticed her acting different if it was just trusting her allies more. Like, I feel like they can't totally let her in because Snow, I feel like he's a smart enough villain that he would catch on to a plan if it was too obvious.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that that's why they don't tell her. Not to say that she couldn't play along. I think that she's played along, but that is why they don't do it. And so, yeah, it will leave her feeling very manipulated by the end of this movie.
And here's where I feel danger. I feel like, oh, this is where the alliance breaks, because they got to run this wire down to the water. She's going to go with Joanna, but she wants PETA to come with him. I feel like that's her insurance card. Like, if they stay together, they won't be attacked, but they make them break up. They will not let PETA go with her. She's got to trust them to not attack him or attack her when they're separated.
No, she's made a pact that PETA must be protected. She's always wanting to be by him because she's willing to die for him. Remember, that was the deal she made with Hamish, was that he was to do everything to save PETA, and it turns out that he's doing everything to save her, and PETA gets captured.
It's all at night. It's dark. Like, the wire gets cut, I guess, by the careers. Joanna, what, she pretends to kill Katniss? Like, she knocks her out and puts blood on her?
I think later it's explained that she cut the tracker out of her arm. So yeah. I thought the same thing.
Oh, is that what that was? Okay.
Yeah, I didn't get it until they said it later. I thought she knocked her over the head, then poured blood on her to make her look dead. But I think what she did was cut the tracker out of her arm and then run away.
And make her look dead. She wanted to give the impression to the tributes that were coming that she had just killed Katniss and they didn't need to pay attention to her. They could follow Johanna, and that's what they do. Well, she didn't kill them because the cannon would go out. We haven't mentioned this, but there's actually a very cool device to know when you've decisively killed someone. The cannon is a signal, and then later each night they have projections on the sky that show you, you know, who dies. So I think, unlike Battle Royale where it was all done in titling, I think it's helpful to do it this way.
Which does leave me with a question, because when Amanda Plummer's character dies, I know they show her. I don't remember a cannon going off, though, the moment she dies. And there's that ship comes in and picks up her body, which I guess is going to set up what happens at the end here. But Katniss looks at that like it's really weird. Like, that's not what usually happens when a character dies, that a ship comes in and takes the body. Like, it felt like they were really drawing our attention to that for some reason.
Is that the first time we've seen that? Because that is how they get rid of all the bodies.
I feel like that's the first time they've shown us that.
Yeah, I don't recall it either. I mean, usually, honestly, most of the deaths are off screen, you know?
Yeah.
We're seeing Katniss far away and here, boom, boom, boom. Oh, three more down.
Right. They don't want to show us. You're right. But for example, why she had to climb down from the tree and get that bow right then in the first movie was because she knew a hovercraft was coming to take the body away and it would take away the only bow and arrow.
Okay. See, they don't set that up. That would have been nice to know that there was a limited time to get that bow and arrow.
Yeah. You have a limited time to interact with any corpse before it is removed from the battlefield.
Well, that explains why they're not tripping over dead bodies.
Yes. Right. So I guess, we're at the end here, and here's the point of contention with the plot summary. You say, Stuart, that Katniss, she's gone back to the tree, she finds Finnick there by himself, PETA's not there. You're saying Finnick told her to shoot the force field. I didn't get that.
Yeah, I disagree completely. In fact, he's telling her to get away from the tree. What she's doing, she's going back to what Volz told her in the training room, when there's the force field around the area. All the force fields have a tell. She's looking up in the sky. She sees the tell. She's doing this on her own. I don't know why she's doing it. I don't know what she has in mind, but she just is impelled by the force to fire an arrow into the sky.
Yeah, no, what I meant to imply, you guys are right. He doesn't tell her, go shoot the sky. What he tells her is, remember who the real enemy is. Remember that you're battling snow. So that is a way of saying, don't point it at me. Pointed up at God or whoever's in the sky watching.
Which is, again, back to where I don't think Katniss is a great character, because she has to be reminded to think who the real enemy is.
Well, she was worried about PETA. I felt like she felt like PETA was killed at this point. But I like how you're putting that, Stuart, because that's how I read that moment, is remember who the real bad guy is. Yeah, he doesn't say shoot up in the sky, but he says remember who you're really fighting. And that is why I interpreted that she wraps the wire around an arrow and shoots it up, because that whole force field thing they set up earlier. Like, I love this moment. It's just like she's literally bringing down the system. She's destroyed the games as it's all caving in this very Truman Show moment.
And this was a shocker when I read the book for the first time. I would think anyone watching this movie would think that you're going to get to two people again, that you wouldn't have all of these tributes still alive in this moment, that the games are ended prematurely is really a shocker.
The shocker to me was they were in a holodome. I honestly thought the whole time they were outdoors.
No, you see at one point that she shoots an arrow. She climbs up in that big tree and she shoots an arrow towards the sky so she could see that they're in a dome, because you see it kind of ripple in a dome effect.
I knew there was something, but I had no idea there was a roof that could cave in. I mean, when one of the tributes is dying, I think, is it Amanda Plummer? When they're like, look at the sky, it's so beautiful. Now I know they were just looking at an LCD monitor.
Yeah, no, it's always been a monitor. They've always been in an enclosed space.
At one point, like, they make it dark earlier than it should be.
Yeah, I might have been helpful to see a hovercraft when they're flying them into the arena, if you had seen it from the outside. But I think they kind of want it to be mysterious. I mean, I guess you could take it to be that they just put LED screens that are clear and that's the real sky. But no, I mean, it is All of it is artificial. And I do feel like this arena looks faker. I mean, even though they shot on location in Atlanta and Hawaii and all of that, I do feel like the environment feels more like a set than last time when it was obvious they just went out to the woods.
Yeah, it does feel that way. And I love that moment where she's like lying there as the lights are coming down. You get that beam of light going down on her. Yeah, it does feel like a set, probably because the way that, you know, they have that clock in the middle of everything. But I just love this moment when she brings down the roof and she's lying there. I don't know if a light's going to fall down on her and kill her. I don't know what's going to happen next, but I'm like, ooh, this has just gotten real interesting.
And I wasn't sure what was happening. When I see this thing come, I figure it's Snow punishing her for bringing in the roof and ruining the games. And when I see Hammage up there, I'm like, oh, did he betray her? That would have been a great twist. And actually, no, she is now introduced to the Resistance, and all of a sudden, this movie's become The Matrix.
Yeah, but you know what? Here's the thing. For our donors who faithfully donated to that Matrix series, I'm a fan. You guys heard, I was a fan of those sequels. This is a better cliffhanger than Matrix Reloaded. Like, I'm like more into this now than I was into those Matrix sequels. And I like those ones, but like this, you get on that ship and you got Plutarch there. I'm like, oh, like, damn. And like, you find out District 12 has been destroyed and like District 13 is still around. Like, I would have liked to seen some of this, but maybe we'll see it in Mockingjay. But I'm like, oh, I'm hooked. I'm hooked now.
I'm glad to hear you guys say that, because I felt like you guys were really harsh on the movie last week. But I agree, when you want to end on a cliffhanger, as you typically do in the middle section of any trilogy, you know, be it Empire Strikes Back or Matrix Reloaded, yeah, you want to make people excited about seeing the next part of the story. They didn't need to do that with the first segment, but with this one, yeah, they've actually got two, because they've chosen to break up the last part of the trilogy into two more movies. You're not going to get a complete story next time, but you'll get more of what you're wanting to see. You're going to get a battle. And I love Lawrence's face in this last shot. The way that she finds out, you know, from her boyfriend, from Gale, you know, the one that, you know, she thought they were going home with and it was all over, and she gets this bad news, watching her face turn and seeing her accept that she is going to have to get on the battlefield to be the Mockingjay. I mean, that is a great moment. You do want to see her fully transformed now. We see that she has been evolving this whole movie, even though she didn't know it.
Yeah, and honestly, my feeling is, yes, I'm excited. They're finally getting at the end of the second movie to where I wanted them to get in the middle of the second movie. So yes, I'm very much looking forward to them getting out of the arena. Although it's still called the Hunger Games, I'm guessing there will be a Hunger Games. But I am looking forward to seeing something that is a bit less of a retread of part one.
Well, you'll definitely get something different next time, because I've seen the movie and I know there's no Hunger Games in it.
Well, Jacob Stewart, do you recommend The Hunger Games Catching Fire? Jacob.
Yeah, I caught some fire for this series with this film. Like, I feel like they take a lot of the same beats from that first film, you know, finding allies, getting ready for the games or doing the games again. But I feel like the stakes are higher, they're better, I'm more invested in them. Now this is about a political revolution. This is like 1984 with gladiators and laser guns and spaceships and just a blockbuster version of that film, like where we're going to overthrow Big Brother. And that fits in my wheelhouse. I enjoy those kind of films. So yeah, the fact that this is called The Hunger Games, but there was something more going behind the games this time, I was more interested in. There's a few things. I got minor complaints, you know. Why not show, to build up tension, show stuff going on in District 12 along with the games, you know. Is it going to be destroyed? Is it not? And maybe that's going to be a big reveal in Mockingjay. Maybe, who knows? Maybe there's an explanation for why they didn't do that. But I feel like, yeah, maybe we focused a little bit too much on the games. I want to see what's going on in the other districts. I guess, again, next week I'll finally get there. But I feel like you could have intercut a lot of that stuff here and just to build the tension, what's going on in this world, because I am interested in this world. But, you know, this, is it a complete film? No, it ends on a cliffhanger. It's more of a TV episode, but it's an exciting one, and it's a great cliffhanger. And, yeah, I give this a recommend.
Stuart.
Yeah, it's an escalation in all sense of the word, and in most cases, it's better in every way than what we had before. I do feel like, as you pointed out, Arnie, the lines are just better. I mean, even though the story structure is the same, the writing has been improved by having new writers here. They're writing wittier turns of phrase, and it's thus making the actors better. I didn't have a problem with any of the actors last time. I thought they were all great, but they're even greater with these lines. And you could argue that, oh, they're just doing the same thing they did last week, but I do feel like it's more exciting. They have more money to do it. And so the games are more fun when we finally get there, and more threatening. And so it won't be the same next time. I mean, they've really backed themselves into a place where we know it cannot be like it has before. And that will probably make these next two movies feel very different than what we've had before. You guys are saying that you haven't liked what we've had so far, so that could only be an improvement. I actually feel a little sad about that. I personally believe each book gets a little less as we go along. So I feel like although Catching Fire is not as good a book as Hunger Games, it is a much better movie, and it has set them up for hopefully a trend that will continue. Hopefully the movies we're getting in the next 2 weeks are better than the book that I'm going to be reviewing at Books and Nachos next week.
And I agree. Jennifer Lawrence is better in this film. The writing is better in this film. The effects are better in this film. And I'm trying to decide right now if this is one of those reviews, and we do have them, where we come in thinking one thing, but through the course of our conversation, sometimes our opinion can be swayed, because I came in a weak not recommend. Because overall, while things were improved, it was such a retread of the first one, and there was so little different happening. Yes, it was exploring the world, which I wanted it to do, and I'm glad it did, but it seemed like the same movie. Stuart, you kept saying you wanted them to remake part one with a bigger budget. Here, they did. You know, that's kind of what I feel right now.
We didn't get a complete games. That would be my beef, is that we didn't get all the way to the end of the games. They lost focus. The game is larger than what was going on in the arena, and you don't realize that.
Yeah, I like the ending of this, but truthfully, I still think there's pacing issues with this. I still think there's plotting issues with this. It's an improvement over the last one. It's still not enough to give me a recommend on this, though. I'm going to give it a weak not recommend, right on the border.
Wait a minute. I thought the movie last week was weak not recommend.
No, that was a
weak for me, but mild for Arnie.
Yeah, mild.
All right, so Arnie doesn't like the Hunger Games. I think that's what we're learning here.
Yeah, I kind of feel like I'm Stuart in this series, you know? It's just, this isn't for me. I still think of Katniss as, while she does have more determination and more will, she's still handheld every step of the way. Every time Bilbo needs trouble, Gandalf shows up, you know? I feel like she's the Bilbo.
Movies you recommended, by the way.
Right, but we complained about that. The difference is Bilbo did do other stuff on his own. Katniss started to. She just doesn't stand up enough as a character for me. I'm really, really hopeful that now that we're out of the arena and into a war, that this is going to give me the Katniss versus Snow film I wanted next time. But yeah, this is a weak not recommend.
I'm curious to know that, because I know you guys have had trouble with lengthy buildups. I think all the books are written so that half of them are lengthy buildups. By splitting the book in half, the movie we're getting next week is a lengthy buildup to the climax you're not going to get. So it may be the biggest case of blue balls you ever get.
No, that would be Twilight Breaking Dawn Part 1 and 2, but maybe this will be the second biggest case.
It could be.
Here's what's funny. I have never seen, with the exception of The Hobbit, a single book that was split into two movies. I never saw the last two Harry Potter films. I saw a bunch of the earlier ones. I never saw the last two Twilight films. I can't think of any of these books that were split into two movies that I've seen. So this will be my first, and I am interested. Is the first one even a frickin' movie? Is this nothing but setup? Is this going to be as frustrating as some of those Hobbit installments?
Yes. But it's not to say I dislike it. I've seen the movie. I look forward to seeing it again. I look forward to giving my thoughts on the full Mockingjay book next week. But I just hope you guys have the right attitude, that keep in mind, there's no way the movie next week is going to feel complete for you because they cut it in half.
As long as it's a more enjoyable ride, my problem with the past couple have been that it drags. I'm guessing from what you're saying, the next one's going to really drag.
Maybe. It depends. I like Katniss, so I don't feel these scenes that you don't enjoy with her are problematic. I don't want to see other colonies than the one she's in.
I really feel like you're trying to temper our expectations.
And that might not be a bad thing, because I came into the series hoping I'd like all of them.
And I'm really hyped after this film, after Catching Fire.
But that said, we review the movies as they come out in theaters, so if it does not stand alone, we'll rank it as such, I guess. There's no going back and changing our arrows after we see the next one. So, we will find out next week. And once again, donors, thank you so much for donating and supporting our show. I may not be enjoying the Hunger Games, but I love you. Thank you so much for letting all of us do what we enjoy so much, because we honestly could not if it weren't for your support. So thank you, donors. Jacob Stewart, thank you for joining me. And until next week, stay hungry.
When you fired your arrow at the force field, you electrified the nation. Everyone at 13 is ready for this.
Thank you again for supporting Now Playing, and we hope you've enjoyed this episode in our Hunger Games bonus retrospective series.
Make sure they remember you.
Your support is what keeps Now Playing on the air.
The importance of this moment cannot be overstated.
The Hunger Games films are the property of their individual copyright holders, and no infringement is intended.
You know, in wartime, I think even the noblest of causes can be bent a little bit, right?
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2015, all rights reserved.
Let it fly, Miss Everdeen. Let it fly.
We have never seen anything like this, and we will never see anything like it again.
And we have two screenwriters that, to make up for the loss of Gary Ross, we have the writer of Episode 7, actually, on this.
Lawrence Kasdan?
Episode 7?
Yeah, Lawrence Kasdan's the writer.
No, Michael Arndt.
Well, there were many writers, but Lawrence Kasdan...
Oh, he's the credited one. They got Lawrence Kasdan back.
So Michael Arndt aren't the writer?
He might still be on there. I know Lawrence Kasdan...
He has it on his IMDb credit. I guess you wouldn't lose that if you ever get a Star Wars credit. You're like, I'm keeping this.
No, let me take a look. There were three credited writers, although more worked on it. Arndt is the third name. It's Kasdan is the top, Abrams is the second, Arndt is, I guess, third. So, all right.
But she doesn't know whether she can trust flirty fisherman Finnick from District 4 or sneaky bad girl, not Johanna.
You can say fishy, flirty fisherman, whatever, but you can't say sneaky bad girl.
No, I can't say Johanna because I want to say Johanna.
Joanna.
Because, yeah, when I read the book, she was Johanna.
Yeah, make it as weird as possible when you're reading this book.
Yeah, then you get corrected. Yeah, well, she's just now made the largest statement yet that she is politically aligned with this rebellion. I mean, Prue could die for this. I mean, right now, Prue could be taken out to the shed and no more Prue. So why do I call her Prue?
Primrose, not Prue.
Well, you'll definitely get something different next time, because I've seen the movie, and I know there's no Hunger Games in it.
Oh, shit, I need a new opening then.
I was wondering, like, do you think these are all a year apart?
I thought that Mockingjay Part 1 and Part 2, I might have to repeat myself, but... So thank you, donors. Jacob Stewart, thank you for
thank you for donating. Oh, I got to pay for this?